Today's episode is not for faint-hearted people, because I am going to narrate a horror story. The story comes all the way from India. It's a part of the collections from a book called Oriya Stories. That is, the stories have been written in Oriya language by some of the more popular writers there. The book contains all these stories which are selected and edited by Vidya Das. And you'll find not all the stories are from this genre. In fact, there is just one horror story. So, without any delay, let me start narrating this story, which is called Farewell to a Ghost. And it was written by Manoj Das. Here we go. It was on moonlit nights that the deserted villa looked particularly fascinating. From the river bank, we looked at it in long silences. When, in spasmodic breezes, the tall yellow grasses around it swayed in waves, it looked like one of those fairy tale phantom castles floating on an unreal sea. But though pale, desolate, and eerie, I must repeat, it was fascinating. Generally, we didn't talk during the night, but the next morning, one of us would confide to another, and we would all know by evening that he had caught a glimpse of the girl standing on the broken terrace gazing at the moon or looking down at the river shedding tears which looked like drops of gold. It was nothing new. Yet, we were thrilled every time and would stand on the riverbank again the next evening. Any of us village boys would have done anything to help her in some way. But we knew we could do nothing. She was so near, but she belonged to a faraway world. Besides, it was necessary to check the temptation of becoming too much enamored of her. We had all heard again and again about the gallant lad of a bygone generation who had fallen in love with her. There was a big banyan tree which stood in its mighty aloneness on the point of the river bank closest to the villa. The lad had often slipped away from his home and climbed the tree. Settling down on a branch, he would gaze for long hours into the crumbling room on the top of the villa through its weather-beaten window. Apparently, he could see her sitting inside the room on the cot in her usual melancholy. But did she ever see him? Yes, occasionally. Otherwise, why should the lad have fallen down from the tree unconscious, not once, but thrice? It was all right as long as you could look at a ghost without the ghost looking at you. It is only when the ghost looks into your eyes that you faint. Finally, one summer noon, throwing to the winds all the stern warnings of his well-wishers, he had crept into the villa, climbed the decrepit stairs, and peeped into the room. Perhaps the girl was asleep, for it was said that she wept the whole night and slept most of the day, sobbing in her sleep. He should have behaved more prudently. Even a generation later, we boys censured him for his rashness and pitied him. To be in love was dangerous enough, and to be in love with a ghost was terribly perilous. How could he have forgotten that? But he had rushed up and kissed her before she could stop him. She had shrieked. Many had heard her giggling, sobbing, and her mad babbling. But that was the only time anyone had heard her shriek. The shriek probably would not have been heard by you or me, but just then a popular erratic mendicant happened to be passing by. He roamed about in the cemeteries of our area, coming into the village only when hungry, once in 2 or 3 days. He could understand the language of crows and cows. Evidently, he could also hear what others could not. When the villagers discussed the missing lad, he revealed that he had heard the unusual ghost shriek. A dozen of the brave men of our village entered the villa next morning. They had sprinkled on their heads the sacred water of the Ganges and had hidden pieces of iron under their girdles so that the ghost could not come too close to them. But I can swear no one even thought of carrying sticks or weapons. No one would have done anything to offend the girl in any way. They found the lad lying on the 100-year-old cotton mattress on the cot inside the room upstairs, and dead. That he had kissed the girl was conclusively proved not only by the girl's sudden shriek, but also by the flow of blood from the lad's mouth. That, of course, is the price one pays for kissing a ghost. It was indeed a grim warning. But the people's affection for the ghost did not decline. What could she do if people fell in love with her? She had never asked them to. She had not killed the unfortunate lover. She could not undo the fatal curse that separated her world from ours. Not once during the 100 years she had been there had she tried to lure away or possess anybody. It could even have been more than 100 years. In those days, the Firangis cultivated indigo over the large areas. They were concentrated in Bengal, but some had spread to the neighboring land, that is, our state, Orissa. Their experiment did not succeed on our soil, and they soon packed off, leaving behind the imposing house they had built. As the legend goes, 3 young Firangis had brought a girl with them. She had been kidnapped or brought from the Sundarbans. She was the illegitimate daughter of a sahib by a tribal woman, and combined in her the ravishing freshness and wilderness of her mother's race with the light complexion of her father. Because of her strange origin, she could not mix with our women folk. It was out of the question for our women to befriend a girl with white blood. From the very beginning, the girl revolted against her masters. She was brutally punished. After several attempts to escape had been foiled, she pretended to have been tamed and allowed a year or so to pass. But one day, the Firangis had to go to their headquarters on business. There was an epidemic of smallpox in the area, and the Firangis, avoiding native contact, rowed themselves to the town. When the current was favorable, it took only a day to reach the town. They reached the town all right, though a little late the next morning. A number of excited crows circled over the boat. The 3 young Firangis lay stiff and cold around a carrier of half-eaten food. The girl had an accomplice in this, her desperate bid for liberty, the keeper of the villa, a sly fellow who had been with the company for many years. The girl knew where the Firangis had hidden their gold and money. The understanding was that both would escape with the wealth. But once she had uncovered the cash, the rascal had stabbed her and disappeared. 3 days later, more Firangis appeared. Outraged, they forced the villagers at Bayonet Point to bury the girl's body and searched every house for the killer. A lot of Ganges water had to be procured from the neighboring villages to purify the houses thus defiled. But all this had faded into a painless memory. It was only casually that people now referred to these incidents. The fate of the Firangis or the murderer of the girl did not interest them. It was only the girl that mattered. I mean, her ghost. We always thought of her as one of us, although we knew quite well that she was different. Apart from being a ghost, she was of white blood that had come from beyond the seven seas. Although we knew that that blood had lost much of its relevance after she had become a ghost, we could not help being a little more respectful towards her on that account. There never passed a feast, whether due to birth, marriage or death, without an offering being carried into the compound of the villa in the dead of night. Some young people would carry the food in earthen pots. An earthen lamp too would be carried. The party would always be led by a respectable elderly man, generally the head pandit of the primary school. We juniors were allowed to view the scene only from a distance. After the pots and the lamp had been placed between the villa and the banyan tree, the head pandit would intone, "Unhappy girl, here is your share of the feast which has been given by the benevolent so that we have such and such occasion. Be satisfied with this. And so far as it is in your power, we ask you to guard the village from evil. We have never tried to dislodge you or disturb you, have we? No. But why not? Because we look upon you as almost one of our daughters. God give you peace." The party would leave the place without looking back, and nobody was supposed to look into the compound thereafter. But we did look, hiding from the adults, from our favorite spot on the river bank. In the flickering flame of the earthen lamp and the dance of the fluctuating shadows, we felt as though we saw something mysterious. Our hair stood on end. The lamp would suddenly go out. "Naturally, she does not relish our watching her eat," one of us would say, and we would leave her alone. I had, however, a feeling that when the head pandit implored her to guard the village against evil, what he really meant was that she herself should not cause any harm to our village. His words, I felt, even implied a threat. What else did he mean when he reminded her that we had never tried to dislodge or disturb her? I felt embarrassed. She was so innocent and so good. What right had the head pandit to be hypocritical towards her? Strong, hot winds blew during the summer afternoon for days on end. During these hours, everything was quiet except the wind. The wooden doors of the entrance and the windows of the villa had disappeared a long time ago. Violently exploring every nook and corner of the villa, the wind produced a variety of shrieks and whistles. I do not know why I was fascinated by these sounds. My father wanted me to sleep then, but I would sit up in bed listening intently to the sounds. Secretly, I even felt like going into the villa, for no other reason than to give the girl a moment's silent company. But I was afraid she might not understand my purpose. That checked me. One day, feeling bold and a little proud, I admitted to myself that this was like falling in love, and I blushed. Maybe other boys of the village also felt like me. It never occurred to us that the girl was at least 100 years older than us. Some wise men had told us that once one had become a ghost, he or she never grew in age. It was when we were preparing for the middle school examination that the shocking news came. The government had decided to demolish the crumbling villa and use the land for some other purpose. No wonder that we forgot our studies and hid behind the school wall to listen to the elders discussing the issue in the evening. Can't we request the government to spare the villa? No, since the local zamindar was declared bankrupt, the land had become the property of the government. The government does not show any consideration for ghosts, the village headman said, and his statement was followed by a prolonged silence and intermittent coughs and yawns. Then a lizard tick-ticked and two or three people muttered, "True, true." But what will happen to the girl? She has lived there all these years, has never harmed us. There are innumerable reasons to believe that she is a benevolent ghost. The lizard tick-ticked again, and this time more people said, "True, true." The discussion continued for a long time. All agreed that something had to be done for the girl, but nobody had a surplus house to offer her. And however good a ghost she might be, a ghost was still a ghost, and keeping her with one's family was not a practical proposition. But if nothing was done for her, she would naturally come and settle in somebody's house. It was perhaps midnight when they came to a decision. Long before that, our mothers or uncles had found us out behind the wall and had driven us back home. At the request of the villagers, the demolition work was delayed for a few days. On an auspicious day, a renowned priest, well versed in necromancy, was brought from miles away. He was tall and hefty, with a round red mark on his forehead. He wore a garland of beads, which, we were told, were carved out of the spine of a notorious witch. He never smiled. It was a day of melancholy for us all. Outwardly too, the day was gloomy with clouds, and it drizzled from time to time. Almost every family had brought a little food, rice, bananas, coconuts, sweetmeats or cakes, to offer to the girl. Nobody was barred from witnessing the ceremony, and so the whole village pressed near the villa. For many people, particularly women and children, it was their very first entry into the compound. The presents were arranged in a semicircle on the veranda. In front of them, the priest placed a parcel and slowly removed its cover. It was a complete human skull. There was a stick of bone too. He recited some mantras while drawing figures in the air with the bone, and then, his face flushing, shouted menacingly, "But where is she? I've already pronounced my command thrice. She should have appeared before me immediately. How dare she be so obstinate?" The headman said apologetically, "Look, Baba, she must be sleeping upstairs. She rarely sleeps at night, you know. I will then go up and drag her down by her ear. She'll realize that I'm not one to go unheeded," hollered the priest, and he climbed the stairs. We looked at each other helplessly. I felt like weeping. Should not somebody have told the priest that she was not to be treated rudely? We could hear the priest's thudding footsteps upstairs. And then he roared something incomprehensible, and the sound and its echo made beads of sweat break out on our faces, even on that cool morning. He soon came back with triumph and said in a commanding tone, "There, eat everything to your heart's content and then leave the house." We had almost ceased to breathe. The priest looked at us with contempt and suddenly yelled at the top of his voice, "What? You will not eat? Mind you, that is not going to soften me, Eat or not, you must leave the villa and the village now, instantly. The headman managed to say, Baba, you should perhaps wait a little. She has never disobeyed us. She will eat. Please tell her that it is our earnest request. Our women folk have brought these presents with much love. But the priest did not seem to care. She is leaving. Make way. He shouted at us. Immediately, the crowd parted. She did not eat, but when commanded to leave, she did so without delay. We did not see her, true, but we knew how deeply wounded she must have felt. We felt extremely small. Come on, that is right, I will lead you, said the priest, and slowly walked through the crowd, showing the invisible spirit the way with the pointed bone in his right hand. With the left hand, he gave some directions to his assistant, who remained behind and collected the magic skull and, I believe, all the food stuff. All followed the priest. The village was left behind, and we walked through the meadow for nearly a mile, braving the drizzle and the fear of a heavy rain. Stop, commanded the priest, standing under a tall palm tree. Then he uttered strange incantations and beat the tree with the bone and circled it a number of times. So, from now on, this will be your dwelling. Understand? The priest bellowed, looking up to the top of the tree. He then grinned at us proudly and said in a rather pompous tone, She can never leave the tree. I have bound her to it. Now all turned back. We boys walked with the women slowly, while the menfolk, walking faster, surrounded the priest ahead of us. We walked in silence. But at one point, someone sobbed. Then everyone was weeping as quietly as possible. When we reached the village, the workmen had already started pulling down the villa. Rain should make their work easy, the contractor informed the headman. After 3 or 4 days of rain, the sky became clear. The moon shone bright, and as on other moonlit nights, we boys gathered behind the village to play hututu. But there was no spirit in our play. Eventually someone said, The ground here is quite low. Cannot you see it is still damp? Why not go farther into the meadow where the ground is high and dry? No sooner had he said this than we began to run. Soon we were near the palm tree and our hearts were in the game. We played on late into the night, happy to be near our lonely ghost. And we returned almost every evening till the summer vacation was over. At the end of the vacation, I went to the town for admission to a high school. I had never lived in a town before. Soon, I became engrossed in a variety of interesting things. I forgot about the ghost. 3 months later, it was the puja vacation, and I was returning to my home. From the nearest bus stop, I had to walk several miles to reach my village. I was in high spirits. Suddenly, while crossing the meadow, my eyes fell on the palm tree, and for a moment, I felt as though my legs were paralyzed. The tree was dead. It had been struck by lightning. Its branches were charred and crumbling. With a heavy heart, I started walking again. During the fortnight's holiday, none of the boys spoke of the girl. And as it was the rainy season, there was no question of our going to play in the meadow. Gradually, I passed the age of playing hututu, and my visits to the village became rarer. And the new generation of village and the boys was so different, so ignorant. They were just afraid of ghosts.